Hello, voices. My name is Joe Troy, and I'm a multi-award-winning voiceover and host of a voiceover's audio adventure podcast, a bi-weekly show where I learn about the voiceover and audio industry and share with you all the stories, tips, and tricks along the way. Welcome to another episode, the final episode of season three. Today's going to be a fun one. Anime is Japan's answer to Western cartoons. It's been around as early as 1917, and although it's a Japanese export and can find a long history in the country, the rise of anime in the rest of the world over the last decade has grown at an amazing rate. In 2023, according to Crunchyroll, one of the biggest streaming services of anime outside of Japan, over 800 million have shown some kind of interest in the genre besides USA, in countries like Brazil, France, Germany, and Mexico. Because of this, more streaming services have acquired more IPs to feed the demand, meaning subtitles, which are still used of course, weren't going to be good enough on their own. The need for more languages being required to tell for stories was a must. Today's adventure is about anime dubbing. I know I've covered dubbing in two episodes talking about animation dubbing and dubbing for film, but no two niches are the same and all have their own pros and cons. Anime is very specific, has its own feel and look, so actors have to know about anime or be well versed in the culture in order to execute at the highest level. As always, I've managed to find some amazing guests today to help me on this adventure to find out more. Let's get talking to the first guest.
Hi, I'm Elsie Lovelock. I'm a singer and voice actor. I've worked on a lot of video games and animations, and I'm probably one of the few British voice actors who's gotten a chance to work on quite a few animes. Some of the ones I've worked on are Moriarty the Patriot, Suppose a Kid from the Last Dungeon, Boonies Move to a Starter Town, Island of Giant Insects, Memories, Hortensia Saga, Megatsu War at Zerst, Ishida and Asakura, The Titan's Bride, Showtime, and most recently I am going to be voicing Mimi in a redub of the Digimon movies with the original cast. There are quite a lot of misconceptions about anime dubbing. The most notable, I'd say, is how easy the broad masses think it is, because it's so highly consumed and so popular. People have very strong opinions about anime dubs, voices, and all this kind of thing. It can be quite polarizing, you know, sub or dub, all that kind of thing. And people forget that, you know, it is quite vocally taxing. You have to, you know, be good at dubbing. You have to be able to match mouth flaps. You have to be able to, you know when to come in. You do have three beeps before you say your line, but you also have to match or exceed the energy of the original Japanese dub. And people just sort of think that all of this is kind of a walk in the park, and they think it's okay to sort of slander the voice actors who work on anime. So what I'd say to that is just remember that it can be a little bit more challenging than you think. Just keep that in mind next time you hear a character screaming their lungs out in an anime dub that you watch. Probably the most notable difference between anime dubbing and Western cartoons is that Western cartoons are generally animated from prelay audio. So that basically means that the animation is animated to the voice, whereas obviously with anime dubbing, it's the other way around. So the actor has to match what's going on screen, whereas with Western cartoons, they will get the voice first and then they'll animate around that, which gives a lot more freedom when you're doing a prelay animation, which is what Western cartoons tend to do. So any kind of, you know, little quirky line delivery that you put in and the director likes it, you know, that will get animated too, you know. And there's all these things about, you know, how Robin Williams was like improvising, voicing the genie in Aladdin, and this gave the animators a lot of fun, you know, stuff to work with his impressions. Whereas anime dubbing, it's a lot more straightforward. You have to match what is going on the screen and you can't really deviate from it. You can in some instances, like if it's a comedic scene, but generally you have to match exactly what the Japanese is doing. You can have some freedom, like I said, but yeah, it's quite a lot more straightforward. The sad news with the anime dubbing industry is that it's very, very hard to break into. During the pandemic, I had the opportunity to do more anime strictly because most of the anime dubbing studios opened their doors to remote talent because they knew that, you know, they couldn't go in studio anyway. So they thought, oh, you know, heck, we'll just let everybody have a go. So because I was on the roster of a few of these studios beforehand and some people kindly recommended me, I got to audition for quite a few of them, which is why during the pandemic, like 2020 to 2021 primarily, and a little bit in 2022, I got to do some of these animes as much as I did. However, it is very difficult, unfortunately, to get into it. You either have to live in Texas, which is where Crunchyroll is, which is where the majority of anime is dubbed, or you have to live in LA. And have a good agent who will send you these anime dubs, you know, from places like BangZoom or NIAV or, you know. So sad news, it's very, very difficult to break into. And I don't really know how to kind of describe how to get into it. It's the same way that you would get any role from anything else. But a lot of people want to do anime. And what I would say is it's good to have that goal, but don't make that your focus because you're kind of setting yourself up for a difficult time because it's very, very difficult to break into unless you live in Texas or LA. This kind of follows on from the previous answer, but yes, you either have to live in LA or Texas if you want the biggest shot of being able to do anime. And even then, that doesn't guarantee you anything because obviously you have to be, you know, good at dubbing. You have to have a good voice. You have to be a good actor. You have to, you know, have networking. You have to know people, you know, like all of this process is exactly the same for voice acting in general. But because of how closed off the studios are now, and they pretty much only want to record talent in studio, it's difficult to break into. You know, that's not to say that you could go to either of these places and make a good impression and network and, you know, you could get your foot in the door, but it can take a long time. It's very rare that somebody just turns up and gets like a main role. You know, they spend years doing Walla or bit parts or, you know, just background voice stuff. You know, it can take quite a long time to build up to the point where a studio would trust you with a bigger role. So yeah, unless you had a lot of work behind your belt and moved to either of these places, I would say, yeah, you kind of have to be in LA or Texas to have the best chance of getting into it for sure. I mean, like any casting director in any sector of voiceover, the most important thing to them is that you're a good actor. Anime is very, what's the word, categorical in its roles. So, you know, you'll have like the main character, you know, or the love interest, the mum or the big burly guy, you know. So if a director knows that you can comfortably either do one or many of these voices, you're definitely in for a better shot. So it's very important to either be excellent at one and make that your bread and butter, or be versatile enough to where a director will think that there's a point in bringing you in for these sorts of roles. So yeah, the acting is obviously the main thing. Having dubbing experience is important because, you know, if they brought you in and you come in and you're like, I don't know what I'm doing, obviously that's going to be a bit of a problem. Not that you can't learn on the job, but a lot of anime is also dubbed very quickly. Like they have to meet deadlines quite fast. So, you know, a whole show they're looking to record in sort of like, you know, just over a month or maybe under a month. It's all done very quickly, which is another reason why they tend to go in studio. So it's, you know, they want people who are very capable to come in and do this stuff. And if you're just starting out or they don't think you're ready yet, you're probably not going to have much of a chance until you brush up your skills in those departments. So sorry if it sounds like I'm being just like, you know, too real here, but that's kind of exactly what it's like. Like any casting director ever, the acting is the most important, but with anime dubbing in particular, it's the skills with dubbing, knowing what's going on, knowing the process, taking direction, that will set you up for success in this particular realm of voiceover.
Thank you, Elsie, for sharing some amazing insights there. I definitely learned a lot more. So, we've had a little taste of what to expect. Let's now dive in a bit deeper and speak with another talented actor. Next, I'll be speaking with Kira Buckland, a voice actress based in Los Angeles. She's been dubbing anime for decades and has provided voices for hundreds of characters in various projects. Some of the most notable being Jolene Kujo in JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, Kuki Shinobu in Genshin Impact, and Mitsuru Kanroji in Demon Slayer. I wanted to ask her journey, how to get seen by casting directors, the art of dubbing for anime, and more.
Hi, so I'm Kira. I'm a voice actor based in the Los Angeles, California area. I've been voice acting for about 20 years total, but professionally for about 12 years. I have worked on primarily video games and dubbing. Some of my biggest game credits are Nier Automata, Street Fighter, Soul Calibur, Genshin Impact. I also do a lot of anime dubbing. I'm Jolene in JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. I've also worked on shows like Demon Slayer, Kakegurui, Eden Zero, and so forth. Aside from all that, I do a lot of mentoring of newer voice actors. I help admin a community called The Voice Acting Club, which I also founded, and I write a lot of articles giving tips for actors on their journey, and I occasionally do a little bit of directing and casting, not too much, but I direct people on self-made demo reels and things like that.
So we're going to touch upon the beginning. So you're from Alaska originally.
Yes.
What was the spark that got you into the anime world, and like, what was the first anime that you watched that made you think, okay, I want to go deeper into this?
I think it would have been like clips from Sailor Moon when I was younger and just thinking that seemed really cool. But, you know, at the time I didn't really think about, oh, there's people that do the voices, because it's not something you think about when you're super young. But then in high school, when I was, you know, kind of able to be introduced to more anime, because I didn't have like cable TV growing up or anything like that. So I didn't have a lot of opportunities to watch that kind of stuff. But then in high school, people started showing me some different shows and said like, oh, we have an anime club that meets after school. Cool. So I started tagging along to that. And I knew I was kind of interested in vocal performance. I had thought for a while that I wanted to be a singer in like a rock band, but obviously that's not a super realistic career goal. But as a teenager, that's what I thought I wanted to do. And I was kind of interested in acting. Like I had, you know, tried out for plays and stuff that I never got. But I was kind of like, you know, I knew I liked singing, like doing stuff like vocally, and I liked performing and I liked acting, but I just didn't know if I would be so good doing like stage or camera stuff or whatever. So it was kind of like when I discovered voice acting, it was like that was kind of a combination of the different things I liked about singing and like stage acting and different things that I'd tried out and thought that I might want to do. And especially because I was getting into anime and games at the time, it just sort of made sense. Like, oh, yeah, this is the kind of career path I want to do. But obviously, like where I was living and this and that, I couldn't, you know, you can't just go and try out for an anime or whatever. So I did like I was on like amateur voice acting web forums at the time that don't exist anymore. And, you know, just doing like a lot of hobby work. And I think that's something that we're missing a lot of these days on the internet, because people who are interested in doing that, they feel pressured that right away they have to jump into trying to make it their career. And it's like, no, like have fun, explore this, you know, not everything. Like, of course, it's important that when you start treating it as a business, you know, you want to get paid fairly for your work and all that kind of stuff, which we cover. But it's like, not everything at first is going to be about like getting paid and, you know, this and that. It's going to be about sort of trying things out, seeing if you like it, just doing things for fun, doing collabs with friends. And, you know, that can kind of take the edge off like, oh, I have to find paid jobs right away.
Mm. In your intro, you spoke about the voice acting club, which I know you started. How do you think that helped you in terms of finding people that are like you and just developing your skills?
Well, a lot of the role that I try to take in that community is sort of more of a mentorship role. So, of course, we have some other amazing actors that I've learned from and this and that. But a lot of what I try to do there is provide the resources that I wish that I had when I was first starting out. You know, now there's so much more accessible information on the internet. But before that, it was kind of, nobody knew how to really get into this stuff. They just knew like, well, I think, you know, there's some people who live in Texas that work for like ADV Films, dubbing anime, which, you know, that company doesn't even exist anymore. But it's like, you know, now there's so much information and there's a lot of interviews with actors who work in the space regularly. Conventions are even more of a thing. And I don't know, I feel like there's a lot more information out there. Although then the flip side is it can be overwhelming for people to kind of be like, well, where do I start? Which is why I kind of wrote a big article about like, here's some actionable steps you can take. And, you know, everyone's sick of hearing the learn to act. But it's like, well, there's a reason that everyone who's working as an actor will tell you that's the most important part of being a voice actor.
Do you remember your first role and how did you get it?
Well, it's kind of, I guess it sort of depends because I did a few things like before I was able to move to LA and enter the industry professionally. I technically did a few jobs that I got paid for online, like some sort of like indie game things that were technically published. So I don't know like how much that counts versus like first named role in an anime. No, my first named role in an anime was from a show called Aika R16. Not a lot of people have seen it. Definitely, it's something that aimed more at like adult audience, so not something you want to watch with your kids or younger siblings. But, you know, it's that was my first like named character in an anime. So I was real excited about that. And I think like one of the first roles that I booked that was in like a something that a lot of people watched was I was in the show Blue Exorcist, which was pretty big in like, you know, 2012 as this character named Izumo. And that was pretty cool because it had a short TV run. So getting to, you know, I wasn't in every episode or anything, but just like being a named recurring character in a show that appeared on Toonami at the time and stuff was really cool.
Do you think having some kind of knowledge on anime allows you to do more dubbing or do you think it doesn't matter?
I think it helps because, you know, as much as acting is acting and the skills kind of carry over between genres, knowing at least a little bit about specific genres you want to work in help you kind of understand the styles that are going for. I mean, anime can be, a lot of people say things because a lot of people have very strong feelings about English dubs, but people say like, oh, English dubbing takes no skill. But I actually find it's very much the opposite because you not only have to match a performance that was already created in a different language, but you have to match the exact timing of everything the character is doing on screen. So you have to engage both your technical brain and your creative brain. And I think it can help just like with kind of any style of media that you want to work on to just look at some of the best examples in that genre and say like, okay, like, you know, what can I learn from this? You know, like some of the early anime dubs that I watched were like Cowboy Bebop, Foolie, Inuyasha. Like a lot of those shows were considered some of the best examples of English dubbing at the time, like really just well done masterpieces with, you know, what they did. Because, you know, anime dubs in like the early 2000s were super hit or miss all over the place.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
Those, you know, it's like, you know, even people who hate dubs will look at something like Cowboy Bebop and be like, okay, that was a great dub, right? So I think it's, you know, by looking at like good examples of things that you want to work on, you know, now one of my big goals is I want to work on like AAA games. Like I'm so fortunate to do a lot of JRPGs, a lot of mobile games for many, many years. But now I'm like, I would love to be in like a Western, like cinematic game or something. So I don't tend to play a lot of that type of game specifically, but my roommate does, so I'll just like watch them play in the background sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, because like they play a lot of like Fallout, for example. I'm like, oh, I'd love to be in something like that someday. So I'll kind of like listen to the performances and something like that. The performance style is so different from something like an anime or a JRPG.
Different,
so even though, you know, it's like, well, acting skills, you know, and fundamentals, that's going to carry you throughout the medium. You kind of have to know a bit about the style and the genre that you're auditioning for.
I think it's so interesting the way how some people can land certain jobs compared to others. And they seem so similar from the outside, but for some reason, they just don't. It's like, you know, it's even something as simple as somebody that does commercial reads versus corporate reads, or in your instance, is AAA games versus anime. And it's like, in my mind, that's crazy to me that you obviously you've done games before, but the games that you want to do, you're kind of like, well, I need to still learn and develop my skills. But in my head, I'm like, of course you should have done that. You know, it's really interesting.
Yeah. And I think certain people are naturally, maybe their instincts or, you know, how they started off. Because a lot of my background when I was starting in voice acting was kind of influenced by things like anime and JRPG. So I think that did kind of shape the acting styles that I learned early on. Whereas, you know, like someone like my roommate, for example, who's also a voice actor, grew up playing like Red Dead Redemption, Grand Theft Auto, like that kind of stuff. And so the kind of reads that they are inclined to do is the more cinematic stuff. But, you know, thankfully we can kind of help each other. And, you know, I took a class recently where I kind of learn to hone in more on the cinematic reads, because that's the thing people don't always realize too, is that you never stop learning. Like, even if you are a full-time working actor as I am, it's like I still wanted to make sure to find the time to take a class with a director that I really wanted to work with and learn from, because I was like, okay, I know that she's going to be able to give me notes that will kind of help me figure out like where I'm at and where my weakness is and how to work on that.
Talking about styles, what would you say is the difference between dubbing an anime versus a Western animation?
I mean, the biggest thing, hands down, is just that when you're dubbing, whether it's an anime or a live action dub, which I've done a fair amount of those as well, or even just like a foreign cartoon dub like Miraculous Ladybug, which is done in French first, for example, you're matching what's already there. So you cannot have the freedom to play with things like timing or ad lib or anything like that, because you are restricted to what's already on the screen. Now, how close they want you to stick to the original language performance kind of depends on the clients and the director. Some of them will say, we want to keep it very close. Others will say, well, feel free to play with something as long as it doesn't, you know, stray too far from the creator's original intent. So I would say you have a lot less freedom when dubbing. But one thing that's really nice about it is that you see exactly what's going on in the scene. So you're seeing all the action, you're seeing all the beats that you have to hit. Whereas when I've auditioned for, like, I'd love to do more original cartoons. I haven't done very many, but sometimes when I'm auditioning for them, because I'm a very visual person, so I find it challenging that a lot of times I'm not even given a picture of the character for the audition. So I'm like, I don't know what to do with this. So I just kind of have to look over the script and be like, okay, I need to make a choice here. But it's, I don't know, for someone who's visually oriented, it's just so difficult, because it's like, well, I don't even know where I want to place the voice. Because for example, if it says the character is 17, well, do you want like cartoon 17 or realistic 17, for example? So it's, you know, you just kind of have to, and sometimes, or a lot of times, you don't know what the project is. Like, everything's very secretive. So I'm like, well, what is this, like an adult animation? Is it a kid's? You know, and you just have to read the little excerpt of the script that they give you and try to get as much as you can from the context and the lines and be like, okay, I think it's this. And then you just have to make a choice and go for it. So yes, you do have more freedom, but sometimes it can be overwhelming if you're not given kind of those guidelines to stay in. Now, I assume that when people go in for the actual job, then there's a lot more specific. I mean, one of the very few original cartoons I did was Rainbow High, which is a kid's show on YouTube. And, you know, we did kind of have specific guidance and parameters for like, hey, here's your audition. We liked this. This is who the character is. Here's all the info. Here's what she looks like and kind of what her role is going to be in the main story. So once you actually like get into the job, I feel like then it's a lot easier. But auditioning, man, you're just throwing stuff in the wind a lot.
Yeah. So a lot of my friends in the UK, especially, who want to do the work that you're doing, they seem to think that it only exists in California. What are your thoughts on that? And do you think that's true?
A lot of it is, unfortunately. It's a shame because it does kind of feel like we went backwards a bit, because for a couple years during the COVID pandemic, it was like, because a lot of studios had to close, then we were doing so much work from home. And granted, that did come with its own set of problems. I have friends who do mixing and audio engineering, and they said, like, oh, we hate dealing with home recordings because everyone's in a different space and we have to, in mix, try to make it sound like everyone's in the same room. And it's just, it's a mess. So I totally get it. It causes extra time and money in post-production. But I would like to see at least more, like, global cast centered in different markets, like even if it meant, okay, we have one studio that records in LA and one in Dallas and one in London, you know, I think that would be really cool because then you could see not like, oh, this is the LA cast we always see or this is the Texas cast we always see or whatever. Yeah. Like I just want to see more crossover. And for the couple years that they allowed home recording, it just made such a difference. And you see it in like indie games because a lot of times indie projects can't afford to rent a studio, so they'll have everyone record from home, and you'll have like a big wild card. Like I got to cast for a couple indie games before, and just like it was so cool just seeing, like, you know, the end clients picked the final cast, but I would send them selects, and we would just have people from all over, and it was really nice. I do know that there is some voice recording work in the UK, particularly in London. My friend Elsie Lovelock does a lot of voice acting from over there. I think she did a part in Baldur's Gate 3. And so there definitely is some work there, especially for gaming, to my understanding. But, you know, obviously LA is where a lot of the work is done. So kind of what I tell people is do what you can in your current market, whether that's, you know, if you are in a place where there is some work, to try to get involved with a local agency or something like that once you're ready, or, you know, to do stuff, work for independent clients online that do allow home recordings. Because there even is a lot of stuff like narration, e-learning, audiobooks that is usually done from home. Yeah. It's for like games and dubbing that they're very much like you have to come in. So there's a lot of stuff. Like I know people who just live all over the world and they do that kind of stuff. But yeah, it is harder for games and especially anime. But then, you know, it's like when people are ready, if it's kind of like, well, my career to progress further from here dictates I be in LA, sometimes that's what people do.
In terms of getting noticed, obviously what you do is acting ultimately, and that's where the fundamentals are going to come from. But somebody that's listening to this now that is thinking, okay, this is something I want to pursue. What would you advise to that person, aside from acting, what would you advise them to do to get noticed, whether that's demos or getting more, you know, jumping on forums and such? What kind of advice could you give?
Yeah, I would say definitely audition for stuff in like the indie and online scene. Get involved in that sort of thing. A lot of the actors who are working in my side of the market, like JRPGs, for example, so many of them did like indie games and things like that because that's a big part of what was accessible to them early on in their career. So I think, you know, one thing that I see a lot on the voice acting club is a lot of people saying like, well, I don't have any training or experience, but how do I get in with a studio or agency? And, you know, maybe like 20 years ago, you hear about, oh, they just needed someone who was around the office or whatever. But these days, it's so competitive and difficult to get into stuff. So I think, you know, obviously, of course, being the best actor you can be, because if you're good at what you do and you go and you work with a couple places and those directors might say like, hey, I have something else I want you to read for or refer you to another studio or whatever. But in terms of getting on those rosters in the first place, you know, just trying to do some good work in what you're able to do so that your name gets out there. When you're ready, you want to get a demo produced. Obviously, I have some articles about that. People do not need to go and spend thousands of dollars on a demo before they're ready. That's is just not a good investment if it's something you're going to outgrow or you're not at the level where you will be able to submit to places that would require such a demo. So, you know, it's I have an article on that too, but basically like making smart, the business does take financial investment, but kind of knowing like, okay, first I should invest in training, then I should try to get like a sort of decent home setup, and then, you know, demos eventually when the time comes. If you're just auditioning for stuff online, like you can make your own or have a friend make one for you. And then you can get that fancy industry demo when you're like, okay, I'm ready to submit to studio rosters and stuff like that. And that is not always an easy process because a lot of studios don't have open rosters and it can be kind of hard. Like you have to maybe like either send a cold email and ask, or sometimes people will take like a workshop with them, or, you know, hope that a client will refer them. Like client or director referrals are a big thing. It's, you know, if there were an easy way, like you do this and it's guaranteed to work, then I guess everybody would be doing this, right? But
exactly, yeah. It's one of those questions that I hate to ask, but I ask it anyway. It's like, obviously, like you said, there's no, you know, silver bullet kind of thing, but you know, just that little spark that might go off in someone's head by something that you said. So I always ask it anyway, but I know what the answer is going to be.
Yeah, but I mean, I hope that helps a little. I know, so kind of oddly enough, how I answer the question about submissions ends up being more like what not to focus on.
Not to do, yeah,
people
yeah.
focus on like spending a lot of money in fancy demos early on. And the other thing that I see people focus on or place too much emphasis on is social media marketing. And they think, oh, if I just get a lot of followers and if I do this and that and market myself on Twitter, that it's somehow going to. And like, of course, it helps to have a presence. You know, so much of the industry is based on like human connections and, you know, out of sight, out of mind, sometimes with casting directors. But I see there's a lot of drama and negativity on Twitter. And I see people get so caught up in that it kind of ends up almost being to their detriment. Like, okay, you're spending so much time getting invested in arguing with people on social media, like that ultimately doesn't matter when you could be putting that energy into your craft. So sure, it helps to have an online presence, but unless you're a huge influencer, like we're talking like millions of followers,
yeah,
that alone is not gonna get you hired. You know, it's like, it's better to be a good actor, and you know, it's that kind of stuff is all just secondary.
100%. But yeah, Kira, thank you for joining me today. I hope I didn't take too much of your time. You know, good luck on your journey. I'm sure a lot of people are going to check out your stuff. So I'm definitely going to put all of your links down below as well in the notes, your articles, everything that you do with your voice acting club, so people can reach out as well. And yeah, thank you again.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks so much for having me.
So what did I take away from today's conversations? The anime dubbing world is unfortunately based in Texas and LA, and is very much studio-based. But that doesn't mean there are no other studios in other places of the globe that you can reach out to. Just good to know. Don't make anime your be-all and end-all. It's a very, very, very small niche that, to be honest, is very guarded. If it's your passion, then by all means, go for it, but don't put all your eggs in one basket. Just focus on being the best version of you and keep developing your craft. The rest will fall into place. There are lots of groups online, so use them, be active. Audition for fan fictions and indie JRPG games. This leads on to my next point of the more you do, the more you will be comfortable dubbing and know what's expected of you. Dubbing experience is key, as studios run a very tight budget and very tight deadline. They expect you to know what you are doing and they're not trying to teach you. So when you step in the booth, it's go time. Thank you, LC and Kira, for answering all of my questions and taking time out to be part of this episode. Make sure you check out their work in the notes below, as well as some of the groups discussed in today's episode. Good luck, everyone. It's that time again. Another adventure done. And another series completed. Can't believe it's been 3 seasons already. Been a wild ride. Thank you to all of the guests that have taken time out to speak with me this season. I've not only learned a lot, but I made some amazing friends along the way, and I'm looking forward to what's around the corner in series 4. Make sure you follow the Instagram and LinkedIn pages to get updates on upcoming content and giveaways in the next couple months. And if you have missed an episode, now's the time to catch up. I'm going to be on a short break and we'll be back very soon, but just want to say thank you again and good luck on all of your adventures. Until next time, everyone. Bye-bye.